You're listening to a DM podcast.
All right, guys, my special guest today is Steve McNamara. Steve is a former professional rugby league player and he's the current head coach of the Catlin Dragons in the English Super League. His impressive playing career includes nearly 350 first grade games, which began at Hull FC, took him to the Bradford Bulls, Wakefield Trinity, and also Huddersfield Giants. And he also represented both Great Britain and England in international football. Post-footy, he has successfully transitioned into coaching. I did mention he's currently head coach at Catlins, but he also won the 2018 Challenge Cup at the Dragons and has also previously been head coach at both Bradford Bulls and the English national team. Also adding to his impressive resume has been a stint in Australia and in the NRL as assistant coach to Trent Robinson at the Sydney Roosters and also assistant coach to Stephen Kearney at the New Zealand Warriors. I'm honoured to welcome to the podcast Steve McNamara. Steve, welcome, buddy.
Thank you very much.
All right, mate. First things first, because actually in the prep to doing this, one of the most impressive things I saw from you, mate, your TEDx speech. So I was going to ask just a little bit off the kind of cuff to start, compared to your playing and coaching career, was it nervous to kind of prepare for this and then deliver this TEDx talk?
Very, very. You know, I got asked to do that and I didn't quite know exactly what I should be doing, how I should be doing it. Did a little bit of research. And, you know, when you're in the rugby league environment, when you're standing up in front of a group of people, you know, you get used to that, you know. But, yeah, this was completely new, completely different. Challenged me, took me out of the comfort zone. And I was glad I actually did it. You know, it was a good opportunity to do something like that. And, I wouldn't say I enjoyed it because it was nervous and all that. But once it's done and it's out of the way, then, certainly it was a good thing to do.
Yeah, man, I thought it was actually quite valuable, especially sporting. Yeah, I think sporting people get a lot out of it. But I actually think the business world, like some of the little things that you brought up and some of the things that people probably don't consider, I thought it was valuable for them. So I think it's an actual avenue into a different field, I reckon, man.
Yeah, you know, without a doubt, the business side is really interested in the sports side. You know, there's no two ways about that. And you speak to people in business and they all want to understand how things have worked. And I think, you know, thinking back, one of the subjects there was, it was about the talent that whispers. Don't look for the talent that shouts, look for the talent that whispers. And basically that, you know, what we were talking about there was that, you know, we can all go to an under-15s game in rugby league and all pick the best player out because he's generally the biggest, the strongest, the fastest. But look for the talent that whispers. Look for the, you know, the kid who, you know, has maybe not had he's not as mature as the others. He's not had the same upbringing. He's from a split family. He's not had the support mechanisms, but yet he's competing at a reasonable level. And don't always just look for the things that hit you straight in front of the face. You know, look deeper than that and explore some of that. And it was a good way. And I think it's really relevant in rugby league. It's an early maturation sport. Like you said, the standout players stand out from an early age, but quite often the very best players, and I use Jamie Peacock as an example, who was the England and Great Britain captain for 10 years. He never came through until he was 21,
yeah.
You know, which is late in England. And his talent, you know, it was whispering there, it wasn't at the forefront of it. And if we'd have given up on him, we would have lost our Great Britain captain for 10 years. You know, and you know, it's as good a story as you can get for a player who, like I said, wasn't the standout star as a young player.
Yeah. JP's an actually interesting one because before he made it in first grade, he spent a year in Wollongong.
Yeah,
so he did plying his trade. But again, in my research, I found out that you actually played lower grades at St. George.
Yeah.
So how much was a grounding, except because had you already played first grade though in England before you came to the St. George?
I had. Yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, look, I signed for Hull FC when I was 17.
Yeah.
My first professional coach was Brian Smith.
Mm.
Brian Smith, like, I am so fortunate, so fortunate that he was my first professional coach. I had a good upbringing. My dad was a coach of coaches.
Yep.
My dad brought me up in the right way and, you know, made some sacrifices for me and everything else. But then you get handed over to your first professional coach. Brian Smith came in and he was incredible. He taught so much. He knows more about rugby league than any other coach I know.
Yep.
And he taught us as a whole group on that. We improved as a team and everything else that goes with it. He left and went to St. George.
Mm.
And at that time, for me, I was going great. I was 17. I played first grade at 17. And then you know, I was regular in the team through age of 18 into 19, and things were going great. Yeah. And he actually took my eye off the ball. I got dropped for a semi-final and a final of the Premiership. And it was out of the blue. I think I played 18 games consecutive before.
That's with Dean Busby, right?
Dean Busby, Dean Busby took my spot, and another young player. And at that point, it was when the seasons were split.
Yeah.
You know, so you could finish your season in England and then go across for 3 months and play in Australia. And Brian Smith gave me the opportunity. And although I'd played first grade, I went across there and played under-20s. I think it was
under-20s
at the time, under-21s.
Yeah. Yep.
Best experience, one of the best experiences of my life to go across there, see these kids compete, these lower-grade players. People in that team, Jason Stevens was in that team, Nathan Brown was in that team.
Yep.
I lived with a couple of blokes, Jason Donnelly. I don't know if people
remember
Jason
the Kiwi
Donnelly,
winger.
Brandon Pearson, who tends to Brandon Coston and Scott Parks, and just a whole round life experience for me, and playing lower grades really opened my eyes up. And at that time as well, I had the opportunity to, I worked in St. George Leeds Club.
Okay.
On Jubilee Avenue, lived in an house down there, worked in the Leeds Club part-time. But in the other spare time would be to sit in the coach's office, and Brian Smith was there and Max Ninnis was there, was a very intelligent guy, unfortunately passed away now.
Mm.
And just sat and listened and watched these coaches prepare to coach the team on the night. So great experience for myself.
Mate, I live about 15 minutes away from Cogra. Did you live in the area?
I learned a few things there. I remember the dollar drink nights at the roundabout in Ayrshire. I remember that. It was a Tuesday night. It was great for my career, but obviously great as well to get some other experiences. But yeah, I really liked the area. I really liked the club, and it was a great opportunity for me.
Yeah, well, what year was that, 92?
That was 1991. Yeah.
Just before they because they made the grand final 92-93. So
92. Yeah, 92.
Wow, and, what an experience.
Yeah, it was good. And like you said, Brian Smith, the huge influence. He gave me a great grounding as a professional to start with. He gave me that opportunity to go across there, and then obviously I will pass across again when I went back to Bradford as a player.
Yeah. Now, last night I had Willie Poaching on the show, and he obviously works at Hull KR, and he was telling me a little bit about the rivalry between the two Hull teams. When you were growing up in Hull, who did you go for, and how was that rivalry for you?
Yeah, I was Hull FC, black and white. It's black and white versus red and white. It's the east versus the west. I was actually, lived on the east side, but always followed Hull FC. And it was great. The teams in the early 80s were sensational. Like the Hull FC and Hull KR were at the top of the tree, probably from 1980, which was the famous Challenge Cup final when Hull FC played Hull KR, through to 1985-86. And during that period, some of the overseas influences at Hull FC, Kiwi influence.
Yeah.
You had Gary Kemble, Dane O'Hara, James Lulawai, Fred Aykoy, all playing for Hull FC, and Mark Broadus, Gary Prom, Gordon Smith, all playing for Hull KR. And then he sprinkled in Peter Sterling came for 1 year. Peter Sterling played for a year. I think it was 1985. And, he was probably the biggest name in rugby league at the time. So it was a great time to be a fan. But the rivalry was intense and is as intense as ever now.
Yeah. What about your mates? Were your mates Hull KR?
Yeah.
Did you get a bit of blues?
You have a mix of everything. But, it's strange because it's the only place that there is. It's a city and it's got two teams, and people quite often say you should merge and get together and be stronger and all of that. But I don't think it would ever sort of happen. They merged the academies actually a couple of years back to try and produce more children playing the game in the area. But I think it lasted 3 or 4 years, and now they're back in separate entities.
Yeah. Now, Steve, not every forward gets the goal kick. Number one, who taught you to goal kick, and at what age was this?
Yeah, early, very, very early. My dad, just used to go out and kick the ball, and just go out and spend some time. And, when you talk about, probably from that early age, you learn about sacrifices. And my dad, my dad was just a working class family. My dad was a toolmaker turner. He used to collect the scrap metal, and then we'd jump on the back of his motorbike and we'd go to the scrap yard, cash that in, go buy me some boots so I could go and play and kick and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it was great. But no, he used to take me out there and he used to practice. And practiced a lot and really enjoyed that part of it. So it's a good string to have if you can kick a ball and sometimes can get you in the team.
Did you used to, because when I was growing up, I used to enjoy, you know, the sand and the dirt and making the actual mound before the actual, you know, the tees. Did you prefer the sand towards the new age tee?
Yeah. That's how I grew up, the same as, and spent a lot of time with a bucket of sand and making sure it was wet enough and everything else. And these fancy tees came out and took all the fun out of it in some regards. But they are good now, you know. It was as it was in that day. And you still had then kid that ulky eye, Mike Fletcher. He'd literally just dug his heel in the ground, stuck the ball in, and would kick a ball as good as anybody. We grew up in a country what is football, or soccer, if you want to call it, whichever way around, is number one sport. Everyone plays football. Even if you're a rugby league player, you love playing football.
Yeah.
And so we all sort of tend to be able to kick a ball. And we actually see that when we have some fun in training and games, and you see we might put the Southern Hemisphere boys against the French or the English, and you could tell a mile off which ones are European and which ones are from Australia.
Yeah, for sure.
That does work the other way as well in the swimming pool. You throw everybody in the swimming pool, and you can tell who the Aussies are and who the English are. We sink. But yeah, just different ways of being brought up.
Definitely. Now, Steve, you know, you signed with Hull at 17. So obviously you're quite a talent coming through. Did you make all the rep teams before you signed with Hull?
Yeah, that was the thing. I played England schoolboys, and I played for 2 years. I played a year young, and then I played in my own age group as well. So things had gone like successful for me. I was an early mature. I was probably bigger than most of the kids. I was one of those blokes that I spoke about earlier, one of the talents that probably shouts and jumps out in front of you.
Yeah,
and that's what I was saying. I was really fortunate then to get the education that I got from Brian Smith as a player, because I think that really, really helped me. And then my first setback was, as I said, when I got dropped from the semi-final and the final. My career was going swimmingly. Everything was going great.
Mm.
And you need that adversity. Sometimes you need that rejection. You need that you're not good enough. You've done, this isn't working for you. And it'd gone well for me as a young boy. So I was 19 when I first got that. And I think that was, I was lucky that I had some good support around me and that I recovered from that, because I see so many kids nowadays who can't deal with that.
Yeah.
They're the superstar kid. They can't deal with the rejection. They can't get, they've never had it. You coach an international team. It's a really interesting one.
Mm.
You coach an international team. You get 24 blokes together who have never been dropped for the last 5, 6, 7 years, never been left out of the team. You can only pick 17 when you leave 7 players out. And they aren't used to that. They're used to being picked every single week. They're the superstars of the game. So dealing with that rejection, being able to cope with that, I think the very best players, as we spoke about, people like Jamie Peacock, they're the ones who come to the fore, those people who have experienced that at a younger age and can overcome it.
Yeah, that adversity that you talk about, because coaching is a cutthroat profession, as you found out. Most coaches, some do realise, some don't realise that you're going to get probably sacked at some point during your career. Yeah. Did that early adversity really help you, especially when you lost your gig in England?
I think, all the experiences, it is cutthroat, you're right. And I see some of the things, I see the NRL this year. Look at the number of coaches who have lost their jobs this year. That's incredible. It feels more like the English Premier League, the football scenario in England. It feels like that. I never used to think of Australian rugby league changing coaches mid-season, but for whatever reasons it's happened, and the scrutiny on everybody is huge, and we accept the scrutiny on us on the field is fair, that's what we do. We put ourselves out there, but the off-field stuff, that's sort of like going a little bit too far, as it looks like from this far away, in terms of some of the things that have been said and done in Australia regarding some of the coaches. Losing the England job, that was for me, that was really, really disappointing. I was in Australia at the time, and I get it, I understand it, that people have the opportunity to change, but I found that out watching. I was actually in Clovelly at the time at the house, sat watching television with the kids, and the ticker tape around the bottom of the television when it tells you an headline, Wayne Bennett's the New England head coach, and it wasn't the way to find out, without a doubt. So that was a disappointing thing. But it is what it is and you move on.
Yeah. Club coaching versus international coaching. How much does that do you change as a coach when you do either?
I think it's completely different. I think there's some similarities with it, but with the international team, you don't work with those players day in, day out. When you're a club coach, you work with those players all the time. You get to know them, you know, really, really well. You know, it's a team, it's a club, you know, all of the bits that go with it. Internationally, and this was one of the things with England, I was really fortunate that I was the assistant coach for England before I got the head coach's job.
Yeah.
I think in some environment, it's best to be fresh coming in, completely fresh coming in. You change your coach and you want a fresh start. But when I took the job over from Tony, I was fortunate that I was the assistant, because what I'd done is I'd seen the difficulties that Tony had faced as the head coach.
Yep.
I actually saw some of the problems that, and it wasn't mistakes that Tony made at all. It was just the problems that was faced as an international coach. Mm. If I'd have been fresh coming in, I would have not have seen those problems. So I, as an assistant, I saw that, hang on, this isn't like club coaching. This is different. We have to, fix some things that will make a difference for us, rather than messing about with things that are not really going to make a difference. And the things that I saw there was we had to create a two-team mentality with England.
Mm.
England was a team where the coach would ring you up once or twice a year, say, congratulations, Tristan, you've been picked for England. Yep. Come and turn up, play a game, and off you go again. And there was no feeling of being a team.
Okay.
So we had to create a two-team mentality that you played for Leeds and England, you played for St. Helens and England. You felt you was part of two groups, and that wasn't the case. We set about meticulously sort of working around that. And then the other thing there was what you have the luxury of, particularly as an international coach, is call it addition by subtraction.
Mm.
We actually could add to our group, strengthen our group, not by bringing something in, but by taking some things away.
Okay.
And by that, I mean some playing personnel that just weren't right for the England setup, the England group, if we wanted that two-team mentality at that stage. And like I said, I could see those problems that Tony Smith faced as an assistant, and then we worked around fixing those areas. It's not about coaching the players to have good marker player or come off your line square or all of that. It's more about making that group of players feel like a team, because the quality of players, and they take over.
Yeah. From an outsider's perspective, looking at what you guys were doing, like, it felt sometimes weird because, you just mentioned Tony Smith. He's Australian. Wayne Bennett is Australian. I just felt that England and Great Britain were playing better under yourself, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what Shane Wayne does now, because you guys are British. Do you know what I mean? I couldn't imagine coaching the Great Britain team because I'm not British. Do you get what I mean by that?
Yeah, I do. I do get it. And like I said, I'm extremely proud of the job that we did with England. We had a world-class environment for that group of players. We had a world-class spirit amongst the players.
Yeah.
We were coming to fruition. We had Sam Burgess, James Graham were at the top of the game. Some of the players in England, people like Ryan Hall was at the top of his game in England. And we were a team. We really were a team. And we just failed. With the World Cup in 2013, I think it was 13 seconds on the clock. Sean Johnson comes up with a piece of magic. But that's how top-end sport should be. The best playing the best. It was a great game and we just missed out. But that feel and that passion and that understanding of what it means to be an England coach really has to come from an Englishman.
Yeah.
What I did when I came to the NRL, I came and worked at the Roosters, which is an unbelievable place to work at.
Yep.
But I was England coach at the same time. So really I was looking at, well, what is the Australian psyche? What is it what the Australians do? Because this is how we do it in England. So really I was sort of eyeing up the opposition. So yep. I really liked the split role that he had at that stage, and I thought it helped our team.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you brought up Sean Johnson. Was it hard to go to the Warriors and coach there? Was it hard to see his face? Because he, like you just mentioned, should have won that game. Yeah. And seeing him every day, because he's a brilliant player, though. He is a brilliant player.
Yeah, he just came up with that piece of play. That game, it was at Wembley Stadium. Like I said, it was two top teams going at each other. Not a lot in it. I thought we were on top for most of the game. Sonny Bill Williams comes up with a carry. You know, in the last minute, we get a nice shot of penalty, gives them field position. And Sean comes up with it. And you know, we had a laugh and a joke when I went to the Warriors about it. You know, I said to him, look, I was probably about 13 seconds away from a knighthood. I was going to be Seth Steve if they won the World Cup. And he took it all the way from me. But nah, is that absolutely fine? That when it happened, when he scored that try, you know, yeah, I think the world stood still for about 5 seconds. You know, you had to be in the stadium to understand that it was sounds, that feeling of disappointment, of losing. But when you sit back and look at it, like I said, that is what top-end sport looks like. That's how it looks like. The margins should be that fine. Unfortunately for us, we were just on the wrong side of it that day.
Definitely. Now, we'll touch more on the coaching at the back end of the show, but just a little bit more on your career, obviously, at Hull, because you spent quite a few years there. What was kind of, in terms of memories, your best memory about playing at Hull?
Playing for your hometown team. Captain in your hometown team. I was 21 at the time.
Yep.
It's funny because another big influence, Royce Simmons, was the
coach. Yeah, he coached you as well, yeah.
At the time. Royce is a legend of a guy. I actually spoke to him a couple of weeks ago. He rang me up. He had a few too many schooners and he gave me a call. And, as Royce does. But, you know, just playing for your hometown club, the team that you've supported, you've followed. You know, as a kid, you've travelled around the country following it to get that opportunity to play for them and represent them and captain them was big. And like I mentioned, Royce there at the time, you know, Royce, now from that initial grounding with Brian Smith and the education of the A to Z of Rugby League, if you like, Royce came in and Royce was just, you know, he taught us how to compete. You know, he taught us how to fight. He taught us how to never give up, you know, how to turn up to play every single week. And it was him. That was Royce all over. And it was great. It was great for me, great for the club. You know, and I don't know whether people remember it. He actually ran 5 marathons on 5 consecutive days. He was the coach. He was retired. But we wanted to sign Des Hasler. We never had the money in the budget to sign Des Hasler.
Wow.
So he did a fundraising event. And he ran 5 marathons, 5 consecutive days. He lost all his toenails. He could hardly walk. But he did it. And he raised the money to sign Des Hasler. We brought Des Hasler into the club. And again, you know, when you're a player and you're being coached by a person with that sort of commitment, it rubs off on you.
For sure. Now, Royce actually coached only a couple of years after he retired because he played in that grand final. He got to win a grand final in his last ever game. Like, I'm not sure if you guys got to see that game live, but
I remember
that as my first, because I started supporting league in 89, but 90 was my first. In 90, I was like 7 years old. So that was my first memory of watching a grand final and watching him and MG just cuddle as he's scoring a try. But he's literally coaching you just a couple of years later. It must have been amazing to see this superstar from Australia and pick up these tricks from him.
He scored 2 tries, didn't he, in that final?
Yeah.
Was it 2?
He scored 2. One in the first half. One in the first half and then one off MG to wrap it up.
Yeah, like a dropout, yeah. And no, he wasn't. And we, you know, from England, like we... Now, maybe we did this too much as young kids. We put the Australians on pedestals because it was, you know, you remember in 82 and 86, or you might not remember that, but 82 and 86 and 90, the touring Kangaroos we all just as kids, we just wanted to go and watch and see these superstars of the NRL. And Royce was part of that, of all that crew coming through. So, yeah, to see that him doing that, to then watch him in the grand final and then for him to come across and coach us. We were fortunate as a group that we had a couple of people like that. And then when he brings someone like Des Hasler across, you know, I'm 21, I'm the captain of the club.
Yeah.
He's made me captain, but I've got this 33-year-old Des Hasler who was just like, again, when you talk about commitment and the way to train and the way to prepare, you know, we've got probably the world's best there in our ranks as well. So, yeah, really good influences.
The madman Des Hasler himself. Mate, 92, did you tour Australia with Great Britain?
Yeah, I did. I was on holiday. I was in a standby squad.
Yeah.
I remember going on holiday to Greece. I was been there one day and got a phone call. There's no mobiles then. It was like in the hotel room and the England manager called me up and said, we've had an injury. Les Holliday's got injured.
Yeah.
Where do you want to come? You've got an hour to decide. And I said, mate, I don't need an hour. I'm on my way. So tell me where to be, what to do. And flew out. I think I went from a Greek island into Athens and then into London to get a visa and then direct there into into Australia. I remember landing at Sydney Airport. Myself and David Myers, a lad called David Myers, were called up. And
yeah.
We got the chauffeur took us across in the Manly Pacific and takes us in and says, "Oh, the boys have got a day off tomorrow." And as you walk in the reception, they're all there on the drink, leaping, just on the table, singing songs. And thought, wow, this is welcome to the Great Britain tour. But yeah. Awesome memories, great memories. You know, Ellie Ramley was on that, Andy Gregory, Sean Edwards, all those types of people. So again, it was, I was just lucky to do that.
Yeah,
And get on that tour and play some midweek games.
Did you get to play? Because, see, my brother, he supported Parramatta, and you guys played him in one of the midweek. You remember when Martin O'Fire had to race Lee Odenright? It was that day.
Yeah, I do.
Did you play that game?
I came just after that, and I do remember that, but I came after that, and we played at Newcastle. Then we played up on the Gold Coast when Wally Lewis was coaching.
Yeah, okay.
The Gold Coast, and then we went across New Zealand, and we played a couple of games and a couple of tests across there as well. But that was the year '92 where Great Britain beat Australia in Melbourne at Princess Park,
yep,
and beat them convincingly as well. And it went to a decider up at Brisbane Lang Park the week after.
Yeah, back in those days, Great Britain had a bit of a habit of winning that first game. It used to, because we used to come up like watch. Wake up early and watch these kangaroo tours. Yeah. You know, you mentioned a few of them, but mostly mine was 90 and 94. And we lost both first tests in both those series.
Yeah.
And really sent a rocket up here in public in Australia. We really thought we were going to lose those series.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and that's been the habit. You know, we've not been able to, we haven't beaten Australia in a one-off test for long, too long now. But in terms of the actual test series, winning an Ashes, winning a World Cup, we've not been able to get across the line. And that's been the thing. We've been good enough for one game, but not good enough over a period of time. So, regardless, the level of competition has always been fierce. It's always been fierce. And it's so interesting. It's interesting to see in the NRL now. Because again, when I was coaching at Bradford as a young kid, at that time at the club, we brought Sam Burgess there, George Burgess, Tom Burgess, John Bateman, Elliot Whitehead. Wow, if we could have kept that crew together at Bradford.
What a pack.
It would have been some. But I just think it's a credit to the English players. We don't have as many players as you do in Australia, but the ones that have come across the NRL have been fantastic. Without a doubt, they've really added value to your competition. Yep. We've just got to pull all that together now and get across the line in a test series.
Yeah, totally agree. Mate, the first time I actually watched you play, because I support the Sharks, and 97, you were playing for Bradford and you played them in the World Club Challenge. We came over there and then you came over here. And then obviously you also played for Great Britain when they sent the Super League Australia. So I got to see you play a little bit and I was quite admired by this, your work rate and your defense was just first class. But how did you first get that move to Bradford?
Say again, sorry.
How did you get that move to Bradford?
Well, I was all FC at the time, and the ambition of the club wasn't great at that stage. Mm. Brian Smith had come back. He came back and coached Bradford. He took the job there and made an approach there. I'd actually agreed to go to Wigan just before he got the job, and then it sort of all changed around. Brian came there, and the opportunity came to go to Bradford. It was the start of the Super League. It was the start of the summer era. It was probably one of the best times for Rugby League in England. The start of the summer era, Bradford Bulls, Leeds Rhinos, Wigan. There was huge crowds, lots of interest. And that team that Brian put together at Bradford, it was probably the first time I'd been involved in a team where all the pieces of the jigsaw fit together. Like he put this group together, what was a strange group. Individually you'd look at us and go, not quite sure with all of this, but it fit together. Like it really did. And I don't know whether you remember the name Graham Bradley, the Penguin.
Yeah, the Penguin.
The Penguin was a huge influence in that team at that time. But again, he couldn't touch his toes, he could hardly move, but it fit, it worked within the group that we'd had. And we started really the Bradford Bulls, the summer era. Everything good about the Bulls started from that point.
Yeah. Steve, can you describe, because I've never been to Odsall Stadium, but from watching it on TV and seeing it on Google and all that sort of stuff, the place looks scary. I can only imagine what it would be when there's fog and there's night. Like, what was it like playing there?
It's great if you're a Bulls player. It was great. And the best way to describe it is just imagine a quarry. You know, imagine digging a quarry underground and then putting a stand around the side of the walls, and that's it. So when you enter the stadium, you enter on the bus and you see the tops of the floodlights. So you sort of like level with the top of the floodlights, and then you have to go down. You know, the bus has to wind its way down to get down into this cauldron sort of scenario. It's a bit like Gladiator, like that, and that's how it was, and it was a tough, fierce place. And like I said, at that time we were averaging, you know, between 15,000 and 20,000 people were coming into that, and it was, well, we kicked off at 6 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon in summer, and it was just a spectacular place. The concourse around the ground, the actual field, sort of lent itself, because it was an old speedway track around it. So it lent itself to all this sort of razzmatazz and carnivals and everything else going around, and it just worked. And it was like I said, the start of that summer era. Big crowds, all the razzmatazz that goes with it, but a team what was really, really good on the field as well.
Yeah. Now, you spoke about the success. Now, in terms of grand finals, they didn't bring that for a couple of years, right? Because you won a premiership 97, correct?
That's it.
And Challenge Cup as well. So
Super League started. It was still first past the post, if you like. And that's how we did it in England. And we won that. I think we won 20 out of the we won our first 20 games straight.
Wow.
And it was great because we was on £500 a win at that time as well. So we were like every week, we was like, this is it. This is us. We won the title that year, and then they brought the actual premiership as it sits like in Australia now in 98 grand final. We missed out on 98. We didn't have a great season 98. 1999, we returned and played our first grand final at Old Trafford, got beat in that game. And since then, obviously, that's the way the competition's been run since.
Yeah. Now, you've won a Challenge Cup as a coach, and obviously you've played in a couple as a player. The Challenge Cup versus the Premiership, can you describe it for us from Australia?
We had this conversation last week with our playing group. We played the Challenge Cup last week. We were in the
against Wakefield, last 16, right?
Against Wakefield. We played Wakefield. And we actually sat the group down for the benefit of people like James Maloney, Israel Folau, some of our overseas players, to actually ask them, Do you know what the Challenge Cup is? Do you understand what the Challenge Cup is? Do you understand what it means in our game? And just went through the history of it a little bit, you know, and so on and so on. It was the first trophy that, as a Catalan club, we've ever won. So it's huge in our recent history as well. And you can't underestimate it. And I think it's one of those games, isn't it, where I know the Australians used to wake up early. Was it early or stay up late? Whichever way around it is.
Yeah, it was. It was about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning,
Yeah, it was probably the one game that you would probably get, and it was because it's live on BBC, which again, you know, the games are on, you know, Sky TV, the regular Super League games. BBC, I think it was 1.4 million people watching last week. It's a huge thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's different. So trying to choose between that is really, really difficult. And we often have that debate ourselves. So I think the best way is you go hard for both of them. If you keep going in them, you keep going. If you fall out of one, then you turn your attention. But it's got that tradition. That's what it has got. It's got that tradition. And the trophy is a sensational trophy.
Yeah.
And it's Wembley. Wembley is iconic. You know, but quite often people don't talk about the Challenge Cup final. They talk about Wembley. We're playing at Wembley. And that's what Wembley does. So, yeah, very hard choice for me. I'm not sure. Love to win a premiership. That would be the ultimate now for us as a Dragons, because we haven't done that yet. We never give up on the Challenge Cup.
Yeah, Steve, watching the highlights the other day of the cup that you won, one of the things that really does stick out is they let the coaches lead the team onto the field, which is amazing, because most coaches, it's like the only sporting event in the world. I can't even think about football where the coach gets to actually lead the team on the field. What's that like?
Yeah, that is sensational. It's, you know, the chairman, the owner goes at the front, then the coach, and then your team follows behind you. And that's a, you know, for the coach, it's good. It's part of it, and you get the feel for it.
Yeah.
But it's more for me, for the owners of the club. The owners invest so much of their own time, their own finances into an organisation, and you get your one day out. You might only get your one. You might only get it once in the lifetime of what you're doing, but that's the payback for the owners, for me. And that's the important thing. So, you know, our owner, Bernard Gouache, when you talk about blokes who work hard, he starts work at 4 o'clock every morning.
Wow.
Every morning he works, starts at 4 o'clock. He works through to 11:30. He has a couple of hours siesta off. He starts again at 3 o'clock and he works through till 8 o'clock at night. That's his daily routine. That's what he does. And then on the side, his love is Catalan Dragons. So for him to lead that team out on that special day at Wembley, to play the French national anthem in that stadium, big, really, really big for him.
Yeah, it looked really, really cool. Now, Steve, the back end of your career, you know, we talked about Royce Simmons having a fairy tale, you know, finish to his career. How much did you learn about yourself? Because Wakefield, financial problems.
Yeah.
Huddersfield got promoted. No, sorry, relegated. And then obviously you guys got promoted after that. But that would have been such a learning experience, especially back end of your career. What was the kind of standout sort of out of that?
Yeah. Well, the Wakefield experience was really poor. You know, I went there and probably what I learned from that was, I remember leaving Bradford, didn't really want to leave Bradford, but was going to Wakefield. I remember driving to sign the contract and had a sick feeling in my stomach, a horrible gut feeling. I was driving there going, this don't feel right, this don't feel right.
Yeah.
Should have stopped, should have turned the car around, should have gone back and said, I'm sorry, but it's not going to happen. Didn't do that. And I really learned from that. As things unfolded there, within, I think it was 10 months, the club was broke, it was bankrupt, everything that could go wrong. But that wasn't that it was Wakefield's fault or my fault. It was just sometimes a player fits a club and a club fits a player. And I just, you know, for me, it just wasn't right.
Yeah.
So I then went to Huddersfield and Tony Smith was the coach there. They'd struggled a bit. The first year, we got relegated, you know, which was a huge blow. Mm. But I remember during that period, because Tony was a new coach at the time, he wasn't proven.
Yeah.
And I think we lost the first 15 games.
Wow.
Like, and your coach would normally, he'd be gone. There's not a chance. Like, we've brought this Australian in and they've lost 15 games. But Tony was, you could see improvement and we could sense improvement. We just couldn't get wins. And it was a really good lesson for me that, you know, in front of the group, Tony was really confident. This is what we're doing. This is how we're doing it. It will work. It'll happen. And as each week passes by, he didn't flinch, didn't move, carried on. This is what we're doing. And we believed it.
Yeah.
We believed it. And eventually we come up the other side. Now we got relegated and we missed, you know, we got relegated by, you know, on the last day of the season, the results went against us and we got relegated. But that for me was a real important lesson of sticking to it. Because when I went to Catalans as a coach, we had to survive the £1 million game when I first got there to escape relegation. And then the start of the full season, we only won two from our first 11. So I was relaying back to lots of these signals that I've got from Tony earlier on. But went back, got relegated. And then thankfully we all stuck together. And it was an enjoyable season, not the pressure of being in the top league, but a fight to get out. A lot of young kids working hard with each other, gets back in Super League, and then the club established itself the following year. That was my job done after that. And then moved into coaching as an assistant at Bradford.
Yeah, that $1 million game you just mentioned, that versus the Challenge Cup final versus the England semi-final, which one were you most nervous for?
It's not even a question. The £1 million game. The £1 million game is, you know, at the other bit, you're going to be successful. You're either going to get to a World Cup final or you've missed out on the semi-final. You're going to, you know, win a Challenge Cup final or you've come runners up. But this, when you're talking about this, you are seriously talking about people's livelihoods, people's careers, not just yours as a player, the whole group, the office staff, the whole club is built around the income of coming into Super League and people's families and, you know, like I said, and livelihoods are on the line on this one game. There is no comparison. That sort of pressure is suffocating. Mm. It's a suffocating style of pressure, and dealing with that and making sure we could cope with that and that it didn't drown us was the big thing going into that game. The other bit, there's more excitement because you're excited about what you're doing. The trepidation of what could be on a £1 million game is massive.
Steve.
You imagine it in the NRL.
Yeah.
Imagine
$1 million game.
You have that game. Wow. And you either play New South Wales Cup or you play in the NRL the following year.
Mate, please, Steve, please tell me that the $1 million game, when you win it, is a $1 million celebration.
Do you know what? It was one of the most subdued from the playing group. And respect, a huge respect to our playing group, because they were playing against friends on the opposite team.
Yeah.
But they knew what the consequence of us winning that game was. So when that final whistle goes, there wasn't a wild celebration. There was, I think it was a year or two before that, Salford beat OKR with a golden point drop goal, and the emotions got over everybody. But our playing group at that time, led by Sam Mower in particular,
yep,
understood the impact it was going to have on the opposition group. And it was more, honestly, it was more of a relief for us rather than a celebration. It was just relief, but it was more a consideration for the opposition as well. It was a really bizarre feeling, a really bizarre feeling. When we got back to France, we flew back into France, there was all the fans at the airport. They were excited, you know, that we'd stayed up. But for the plane and the coaching group, it was a surreal sort of, I wouldn't say celebration, it was a surreal sort of moment for all of us.
Yeah. Steve, grab some water if you want, bud. I saw you reaching for it before,
yeah,
mate.
Yeah.
Smash it.
No, you're right, yeah.
You take your time.
You've not been successful because you've survived the £1 million game. You've just won one game at the end of a horrible season where the coach has lost his job and someone else has come in. So, yeah, you're relieved to stay up, but it's not a success. It's not a celebration of any sort of success.
Yeah, for sure. Mate, grab some water and we'll continue.
Yeah, yeah,
you smash it. I know what it's like when you're chatting. You can get a little bit dry as well. So yeah. I can always edit this out, mate. So all sweet.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the end of your career, and when you try to figure out that you had coaching ambitions, was there a moment that you kind of thought that you might be a coach?
I think right from the start of my career, right from the start, you know, that, like I said, that great education I got at the beginning.
Mm.
And then I still had my mates who were professional players, but they all played local. So I'd go back and help coach them and wanted to help them as much as anything. So I sort of was involved in that, but I always had an interest. Again, my dad was a coach of coaches, a coach educator. You'd go on the coaching courses and he'd help you get through that. So it was sort of in me a little bit in terms of that. And really what happened was when we got relegated in the season at Huddersfield and we reduced the number of staff at the club, I was playing and assisting Tony Smith as well. So I was a senior player, stayed at the club, helped Tony with some of the backroom stuff, some of the stats, some of the analysis, some of those bits and pieces. When we got promoted and went back, we brought full-time staff back in. So I sort of moved away from that role a little bit. But the last year that I played, I'd got an opportunity to go back to Hull FC as an assistant coach under Sean McCrea.
Okay.
At that time. Decided not to take that because I wanted to play one more year in Super League. So it was on the horizon. It was on the cards. It was just picking the right moment to move from playing into coaching.
Yeah. Now, Steve, you've mentioned Tony Smith's name quite a bit, and obviously he's a rival because he coaches at Hull KR. But in terms of, you know, you playing under him and then obviously learning under him as assistant coach, is it good to see Hull KR come up on the schedule now? Do you guys have a little bit of a rivalry, some beers after the game?
Not at the minute because we play the game and we're off into isolation. But no, look, Tony's had a big influence on my career. You know, when I was struggling at Wakefield, he took me out of that environment. I actually played with Tony at St. George. When I was 19, Brian was there. Tony Smith was there. He was part of that group with Matthew Elliott and Mark Coyne and all them old Graham Bradley, all them old boys. So I knew Tony right from back then. Tony fell out of love with the game a little bit at Warrington by his own admission. He was coaching there and he actually had a year out of the game and took some time and re-evaluated everything. But he's come back and he's come back at OKR and he's brought them back into play in a style that is different to everybody else in the competition. I wouldn't quite go as far as saying that it's like the Walker Brothers style, but they take some risks at OKR. They've maybe not got some of the ammunition that some of the other clubs have, but they're certainly throwing plenty at you, and that's credit to Tony's coaching.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you know, developing your own career as assistant coach first, You know, in the NRL at the moment, you see a lot of assistant coaches that probably aspire to be a head coach before they're ready. How do you, in terms of you developing yourself before you're ready as a head coach, what did you try to focus on?
Yeah, it is a good question. I mean, I look back to some of those memories and some of those thoughts and sat in that coach's office at St. George Leagues Club as a 19-year-old and watching Brian Smith and Max Ninnis, and without knowing it, subconsciously learning how all of this fits and gets put together. But I think when you first get your job as an assistant coach, it's all about coaching.
Yeah.
And that's where you get your buzz from. You get your buzz from improving the players, seeing your work with a young player and he adds that into his game, might not win the game, but you see that in the player and your team then starts to develop. And I think it's pure coaching. I think it's one of the best jobs in the world, the assistant coach. You know, there's pressure, of course there's pressure, but the head coach's job is to take that pressure. And as an assistant, if you just concentrate on providing the best coaching you can to support your head coach, because your head coach is going to get distracted, moved into different parts, different areas, particularly in England, where we don't have as many support mechanisms around the head coach as you might do in Australia. There's some, you know, you look at Melbourne with Frank Panisi around Craig Bellamy and some of the other people to support the club.
Yep.
Same at the Roosters. The head coach can get dragged from pillar to post. So as an assistant, just concentrate on being the best coach you can be for that group. And I think that's what I tried to do for Brian Noble at that stage and come up with some new ideas, some plans, some different ways of doing things, keep it fresh and let the head coach deal with some of the politics and other things out within the game.
Yeah. Now, 2014, Paul Green leaves the Roosters, goes obviously the coach at the Cowboys. So there's a spot vacant at the Roosters. How did the opportunity to work under Robbo come about?
Well, it was interesting. At various stages as an England coach, I'd visited Newcastle Knights when Trent was an assistant there. I think Trent was an assistant to Brian Smith at the Knights. And then Brian went to the Roosters, Trent went to the Roosters. So I passed across a couple of times on that.
Yep.
And then there was a couple of opportunities where I think Trent had come across to England whilst I was at Bradford. And so we knew each other. We knew each other. He'd seen how I'd worked and I'd seen how he'd worked. He actually offered me the job in 2013.
Okay.
He actually offered me first then. And I had to say no because it was the World Cup year for England. We were involved in that and I couldn't at that stage take the time out. And I remember actually driving down from Bronte, driving down the hill towards the beach there. And I'd said no to him. And he said, look what you've missed out on. I'm looking at this view thinking, what have I done here? Like, this is like, wow. But then, the opportunity come again in 14. It was a year after the World Cup. The England role was evolving. I was deciding whether I was nearly close to going to rugby union and working in rugby union. Decided to stay on as England coach. So let me do the England job part-time. And Trent offered me an opportunity again. So it was a big decision because at that stage, it was right for me. But I had a family and my kids were 12 and 13 years of age. So they were at high school in England. And disrupting them at that stage was a big ask. But one that I've got to say, it was probably the three best years of our lives across there as a family in the eastern suburbs at the Roosters. I can't speak more highly of the club and the area.
Yeah, it's really interesting because I had Fitz on earlier this year and he's been offered so many head coach roles and he doesn't want to leave. But I guess it just goes to show how good a club it is to be at and the support mechanism that Robbo and obviously Politis has created as well. What is it like in that regard?
Yeah, when you talk, I mentioned the word sort of jigsaw earlier on. When I spoke about Bradford Bulls and the actual team on the field, how that fit, I think there's a pretty much of a perfect fit there at the Roosters. There's a jigsaw, there's a puzzle, what all comes together to create what they've got. Now, the Roosters have always been situated in that area. They've always been in the glamour part. And anybody who knows it, on the edge of the city, close to the beach, it's the eastern suburbs and everything else. So it's always had the attraction for players to go there. You know, it's had the finances to do that. But the jigsaw that they've put together there now, and I mean, don't just mean the coaching staff. I mean the backroom staff as well. You know, some people in the backroom there, Kathy and Alex and, you know, and Dee who work in the back office, all of this, how it all comes together, the physical performance team led by Travis Toomer, the medical by Steph Brennan, they've got some stability. They've got some excellence there. They've got stability, continuity, consistency. It's a place where players want to go. They've now created this environment, what is successful and will continue to be. But for me, one of the most impressive things that they've done, which they haven't been renowned for, is they have started to produce their own players.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Nat Butcher, Victor Radley, there's so many of them now who are coming through that system. And that's something that I think is one of the biggest differences for them now, because if you've got those juniors coming through consistently, you will continually be able to manage his cap. You will continually be able to be strong. And I think what they've put together as a whole group there is sensational. It's flagship for the game.
Yeah. You know, you talk about those strengths of junior development. With your role at Catlins now, how hard is it to establish that junior development within that area?
Yeah, that is one of the challenges now. You know, when I first came in, the job was to survive the competition.
Yeah.
You know, we had to survive. Then we had to build a first team roster that could really compete. We sort of did it the opposite way around. And now it's really challenging to everybody in this area to produce French talent. And we've got some coming through. We've finally got some coming through. And it's exciting to do that. But in Australia, look, you have so many junior players playing the game. And everybody in Australia will say, we want more players. We want more juniors playing the game. Of course they do. But compared to England, you've got a vast amount of juniors. England says the same. England have got lots of junior players, but they all want more. France is even below that. So what happens in France? You can't, it's not a conveyor belt in France. You can't get a kid and go, do you know what? He's not good enough. Toss him away. Let's bring the next one in. You have to polish every single one of them and keep polishing them, because you might get that late developer. You might get that Jamie Peacock. You might get that person. And in France, that's a challenge to get them involved in the game, keep them playing the game. And they might develop a little bit later than they would in Australia, but we'll get those players coming through.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed actually the start of the season before. Obviously, you guys got put in isolation. Some of the players in your team, like, I've always enjoyed watching Sam Thompson's play. Obviously, Jimmy won a premiership with us. And then Israel Folau, before everything that happened, he was a rugby superstar and then obviously a rugby league superstar. There are three. They would nearly go into every club in the world. What's it like coaching three players of that caliber?
Yeah, I think, particularly when you're talking about Tompkins and Maloney, they are genuine leaders. And some of the things I learned, you know, so many things from coming to Australia, but looking at the teams that win premierships, looking at Melbourne when they had Cronk, you know, in that team, the best half, looking at the Roosters when they won it in 13, they had Maloney in that team, looking at North Queensland, they had Thurston in that team. Like, there's a common denominator here that is the team that wins it generally has that type of person in the team. And they're clearly good players, but just because you're an experienced player or a half doesn't mean you're a genuine leader.
Mm.
And there's only so many genuine leaders about. I'm fortunate. The club have worked hard to get two of the best in Sam Tompkins and James Maloney into that group together. So that is, for us, a real bonus. You know, so if you like, we've got the conductors in the team. We've got the conductors that can run us around. When you add someone like Israel Folau into the group, you then add your strike. You know, so you've got the balance between conductors, we're running the show, they've got the strike, the blokes who can break a game up. You know, Sam Cassiano falls into that fold as well. Mm. He can change the momentum of the game. He can shift it by one player, one carry. Israel Folau can do that. And then you need a bunch of workers surrounding that, conductors and that strike, and trying to get that balance right. What is that exact number? What does that look like? Is hard to do. But I looked at the NRL and I look at the teams that win it. I look at how it all fits together.
Yeah.
And those leaders, those people in those key areas, Luke Carey now, you know, look at Luke Carey now with the Roosters, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's taken over that mantle, I believe, in the Australian game, as whether it's a six or a seven, but he's the dominant one and the Roosters have got him. So, yeah, trying to get that balance, trying to put those pieces of that jigsaw together for us as a club. I think we're getting closer to that. It's just disappointing that the season's come to an abrupt halt right now.
Yeah. When you first signed Izzy, you know, in terms of the media speculation, the pressure of that signature, what did you do yourself in terms of trying to keep that away from the group and not to let that distract the team?
Yeah. Well, you know, putting it bluntly, I think my balls were on the line on that, not anybody else's. You know, and I knew that. I knew that making that decision. I knew the controversy and what it would bring. But, you know, I read the headlines, same as everybody else. My job was to look at that situation, fully explore that situation, speak to Israel, understand it, feel it. And I'd met Israel, you know, but whilst I'd been in Australia, I'd bumped into him in the cafe at the stadium, and he seemed a thoroughly good guy. And so my job wasn't to read the headlines and just go along with everybody else. It was to understand this a little bit more. Why is this comment? What is this said? What does it mean? What does, you know, and everything that goes with it. What for me, I was that comfortable after speaking to him and understanding his situation and not agreeing with the comments that he said by any means, but we're all entitled to different opinions. I was that comfortable that it was the right thing to do. That is easy for a coach to sell. If there's any doubt yourself, you can't sell a project. You can't sell anything to anybody if you've got an element of doubt, because that comes out in you. But after what I did in the research, I thought, this is right. This is the right thing to do. Let's give him this opportunity. Clearly spoke to some of our senior players about it, because it was a very touchy sort of subject, if you like, you know, and, you know, could have had an impact on the team negatively. So I had to make sure it was going to be a positive impact as well. There was some good debate amongst that. But once Israel came in and people saw who he is and he explained to the playing group his situation, they warmed to him and took to him. And the most impressive thing for him is that how he's impressed the group is his work ethic. He's prepared to work really, really hard for the team. We all know the flash stuff. We all know the brilliant stuff. But he's working so hard for the team at the minute, and that's what players admire about him.
Yeah, nice, mate. I've got a theory that Kevin Walters is going to give you a call if he hasn't already, because Queensland have got no centres, and Izzy's in good form. So it wouldn't surprise me. I'm not even sure if what the origin rules of eligibility are, but if you would allow him, well, like,
If you can send me Kevin's number and I'll block it so he can't get through, that's probably the best. It happened though, didn't it? I remember a few
friends Alan Langer
coming and playing at Wellington, and they brought Alan Langer back. But look, you never say never. But listen, in this world where we're at right now, in terms of being able to travel and everything else, it's extremely difficult for anybody.
Yeah. Now, final topic, Steve. Now, the sacrifices of being a coach and family. Now, you mentioned your two kids, and we had a brief chat about them before, and obviously they're both doing very well. You know, your daughter, obviously, you know, doctor, and then studying to be a doctor, and then obviously your son just broke in to the 21 at Hull, correct?
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about both of them, and then obviously your kind of unique situation between yourself, your wife, and your kids.
Yeah. Yeah, look, we went, you know, 2014, we went to Australia as a family. Like I said, the kids were at a funny age, and in terms of high school, they were already at high school, we're changing them high schools, so we were bright kids. We did the three seasons at the Roosters. And then there was at the age where the kids could go back to do their exams in England. It was at that age where both the sort of years fit there, so we decided that they would go back and finish their English exams, make sure they've got the qualifications there. We weren't quite sure where rugby league would take us, so we didn't want to, you know, we wanted to make sure their future was safeguarded. They loved the time in Australia. They've got some great friends, great experiences, had to overcome some adversity and everything else that goes with it, all the lessons in life that you need. But they went back, the smart kids, the bright kids. Michaela went back, she looked after after that side of it, and I went to New Zealand Warriors, and went there for, well, it was only eight, 9 months in the end before the Catalans job came up. But it's look, at different career stages of your career, whether your kids are young, whether, you know, the middle age, whether they're grown up, everyone goes through this. And at the minute, it has been for the last, it's a number of years now, probably just over 3 years. It's worked for us in terms of Michaela looking after the kids and me being out here doing the job. It's not easy. It's a sacrifice. You're right. It is a sacrifice. But there's plenty of people do those sacrifices in any sorts of walk of life. Look at the military service. You look at lorry drivers and whatever it may be. So it is what it is for now. And, you know, like I said, it's worked out good. The kids are both on the right track, which is the most important thing.
Yeah. Now, just with your young bloke, you know, obviously he's fast approaching the possibility of you having to coach against him. Have you had a chat about or a bit of a laugh about you guys having to face each other?
Yeah, sort of. Like he's a good kid. He's done, you know, he's done well. He's carried on his education. He's finished that now. And he's full time with the Hull FC, obviously a rival Super League club. And he's forging his own way, and he'll either make it or he won't make it. He'll do it on his own steam. And but he's a dedicated kid. So, but yeah, I mean, they could come to that point where, you know, he might get an opportunity. It might not be this year. It might be next season. Whatever it may be, where we have to, you know, cross paths and come across each other. It'd be very interesting. Obviously, would imagine Nathan Cleary and Ivan Cleary probably did that. But I think it's a little way off yet for Ben. He's 18. I said, he's doing okay, but it's a little way off, a little bit off that point yet. So we'll cross that bridge when we get to it.
Is he a forward like you? What's his style, sort of thing?
No, he's a half. He's a half stroke hooker.
Okay.
So yeah, he's an intelligent kid, and he's an intelligent football player. He's fit and healthy. And he'll give himself every opportunity. And like I said, if it works for him, great. If not, then he'll go find somewhere else, I'm sure.
Mate, he would have seen some dressing rooms back at the Roosters. And
I think about that, some of the interesting stuff that he's seen, and, you know, some of the things that I've spoke about when I was, you know, sat in offices and that, and some of the signals that I've picked up from dressing rooms, both in, you know, England dressing rooms, you know, Roosters dressing rooms, you know, even the Warriors when he came out there. He's had some he's been able to experience some great cultures and some different cultures and see how things work in different environments. Even at the Catalans, you know, he's come across and visited and seen how we do things across here. So, yeah, it's a good start for him, but he's on his own 2 feet now. And like I said, he's enjoying what he's doing.
Mate, it'll be funny one day when he runs over Jimmy Maloney. You used to see him in the dressing room as a 12-year-old, and now as an adult, just running straight over the top of him.
Yeah, some mixed feelings then, definitely.
Now, Steve, final question, just my dinner party question. You've got 5 invites to a private dinner party. Now, only rules, no family or friends, but you can invite anyone dead or alive. Who would Steve McNamara like to invite to dinner?
5,
my friend.
Wow. I've never really thought about this. Muhammad Ali would be one. Bring him across. Probably Pete Sterling then would be another one, because I would like to, you know, that Hull FC fan, that him coming across at that age. He would be 2. I'm rubbish at this sort of stuff. 2, that's 2. So he can't be family or friends, that's what you're saying, isn't it?
No.
Yeah.
Not unless you have like a grandpa that passed away without meeting him or something like that. Then I would allow it.
Well, I'd probably ring Jimmy. Jimmy Maloney would come just to, you know, because he'd just keep the party going all night. Jimmy, he'd be lively enough there for us.
How's he been at training, mate? Has he been a pest?
Every day, every single day. Awesome for the group. I will say, like, he's, you know, he's come across, he's playing well.
Yeah.
You know, and the way he is with everybody, you know, whether it's the youngest French kid to the oldest overseas player, he's the same with everybody.
Yeah.
And that's what people love about Jimmy. There'd be 3. You've got me. Just, I need to start this. I need to start this question again. I'll tell you what, whilst I'm thinking, the one question, one thing that I would want to talk about, which you hadn't asked, was because you wouldn't know about it, but the challenge of coaching Catalans when I first came, because the interesting story around that is, as a coach player, you need to get a trust relationship. Like, every relationship relies on trust, but how do you speak to a group? How do you get trust when you can't speak to a team in its own language?
How many people were French?
A lot.
Yeah.
You know, over half the squad now, all the junior players, all the staff, everybody, you know, is French. So can I just talk about that for a minute?
Absolutely, because I find that fascinating. See, because for me, for my background, both my parents were born in Mauritius, so they're French-speaking. Yeah. So I can fluently understand it, but I can't talk it back. So I can imagine you arriving in France. I'm not sure if you knew how to do either, like what the challenges of all that. So I find that fascinating, mate. So go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was incredible challenge, because you imagine you coming across to a team that's just changed its coach. So the team's not going well. You know, it's not changed its coach for no reason, so it's losing. But then you go across and you can't communicate freely with the group. So how do you gain trust with a group? You know, with any, well, how do you gain trust in any relationship? You communicate, you speak to each other, you get a common ground. Now, if you can't communicate with a group completely, or an individual,
yeah,
and they're not playing well, so all you tell them is, anything you tell them is negative. So the only things you can tell them is negative. I think you're on the wrong foot in there. So when I went to the Dragons, I made a really conscious effort of positive coaching, because of this communication barrier to start with in particular. I wanted to, you know, things was needed to be more positive. They were actually a really well-coached team when I got there. I thought they were well-coached, but they had too much choice.
Yeah.
And so they were okay at lots of things and not really good at anything. So we reduced choice, if you like, addition by subtraction. We reduced that choice, and then we went on this campaign to positive coach, and to get that trust, and then also asking the French players to help me. So I would say, look, what is the word for this? You know, the table, they'd tell me what that word was, and it was a two-way thing. They were actually, I was there to help them improve, but I needed their support and their help to help me through life as well. So it was actually a really good way of gaining trust with a group that I couldn't, like I said, openly communicate with. You know, respect to Trent when Trent was at the place. Yeah. He's got a French wife, he spoke fluent French, and that's a great skill set to have. But like I said, when you first go into an environment, what's beaten down, it's losing games, it's negative environment, and you can't communicate, that was an awesome challenge for me as a coach to overcome right at the beginning.
Yeah, I tell you what was really interesting. Tony Gigo, because I remember him playing a year at Cronulla in reserve grade. And then the next time he just disappeared. And then the next time I saw him, he was playing for you in the Challenge Cup final. And I think he got man of the match, didn't he?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah, and that's Tony. You know, he's had I wouldn't say a checkered career. He's had an interesting career. He's sort of been around and flitted around and had a couple of suspensions for some misdemeanors, but found his way back and found some incredible form leading up into the Challenge Cup final, took it into the semi-final and the final. And we win the first ever trophy for Catalan Dragons, you know, at Wembley, like an incredible experience. Tony, a French player, gets the Lance Todd Trophy, which is a prestigious trophy of the man of the match in the grand final. And then on the back of that, it opens up for us as a club an opportunity to play at the Nou Camp Barcelona's ground the following season.
Yeah.
Now, the Nou Camp is a spiritual home of Catalan people. Catalan spreads from the south of France across the first part there of Spain. It's a region. And that region fights everybody. You know, it's ferocious. You know, even now they're fighting for independence. The Catalonian people are fighting for independence. You might see it in the news. But for winning at Wembley as a French club, to open that door for the Catalan people to take us in. I mean, we went to the Nou Camp to take the trophy. It was Barcelona were playing Girona, and there was 90,000 people in the stadium. They took the Rolders out on the field at halftime of that game. On the back of that, the invite came to play Wigan. We played Wigan during the season, Super League record crowd at the Nou Camp in Spain. And from winning that trophy at Wembley, it opened a few doors for the club and for the French people.
Yeah, Steve, you know, you talk about Barcelona. You know, I was just before we got on, I was just reading about Messi leaving. How is even like, because you're about half an hour, aren't you, from Barcelona, but it's still the region.
2 hours. Two hours. We're half an hour from the border of Spain.
And then another.
Barcelona is two. Yeah.
But I'm assuming that that impact from that club will spread all the way back to you guys, right? Yeah. Like, has it been little bit hostile?
It's like a death in the family.
Yeah.
I think it's difficult. And we've got one of our assistants, Tom Abos, is a crazy Barcelona fan. And they got beat, I think it was 8-2, didn't they, by Bayern Munich in the Champions League. And on the back of that, Messi tells everybody he's going to leave. And it is the influence he has at that club and has had is immense. I remember playing at the when we played at the Nou Camp, and we were talking about which dressing rooms we were going to use. Yeah. We had to wait for permission off Messi to be able to use the Barcelona home dressing room. That to that level, it was him. It was him. It wasn't the club who gave us permission. It was Messi. He was waiting for Messi, and that sort of tells you the sort of influence and impact that he has on that club. But the Catalan region is we're in the south of France. Everyone thinks it's glamour, it's glitz. That's Monaco, that's Nice, that's Saint-Tropez, that's the other part. We're in a real working class environment which spreads the Catalonian region. And these people are tough people that they work hard around here. And they like their teams to play in that same style as well.
Yeah. Actually, mate, ever since, you know, I was doing a bit of research, I've been looking up the area. Next year, if they open the borders back up to us Aussies, I'm definitely coming over, mate. I'll shout you a couple of beers.
Tristan, honestly, if you get, you know, we're not going to be using it, mate. If you get a chance to come, give me a shout. It is awesome. Like, it's awesome because we're winning now and we're playing well and we've got a good squad. So the benefits of being in a great part of the world opens up. When you're losing, you can live anywhere you want. It's not a good feeling. But, you know, the border is literally, 20 minutes away to the border. The mountains behind us, if you like skiing, like in April and May, you can be skiing. Mm. And in an hour and a half, come and sit on the beach and go in the sea.
How good's that?
Like, that's, and you don't get many places in the world like that. So, all right, I need these five people, don't I?
You got two more, mate.
Fucking hell, man. I'm going to have to start this question again, though.
You had Muhammad Ali, you had Michael Jordan, you had.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Who was the third one you had?
No, I didn't have Jordan.
Did you have Jordan?
No, I had Pete Sterling.
Oh, Sterlo, sorry, mate. Yeah,
Muhammad Ali.
Yep. You had Jimmy. You're bringing Jimmy. So
I was going to bring Jimmy.
You know, you're admitting that you're not, because I just said no family or friends, so you're admitting that James Maloney is not your friend.
He's a work colleague, not a friend. he's a work associate. He's not a friend. Nice. Mate, I can't even, you've got me. I can't even think of other people. Ah, no. Okay. I've got it. Yeah. I've got another one.
Yeah.
Pep Guardiola.
Yeah. Nice.
Right. So he's a Catalan legend and obviously whatever. So I've got Muhammad Ali, Pep Guardiola, James Maloney, Pete Sterling.
Yeah.
I need one more.
Have you got, hey, Steve, at home, do you have Amazon Prime?
No, but I've heard about.
Oh, there's that Manchester City show with Pep, and they go behind the scenes and just follow him around. It's brilliant, mate. It is brilliant.
Yeah. I've heard so, yeah. There's a Tottenham one out as well on Netflix at the minute. Mourinho, that's supposed to be good.
Okay,
I'll go with him as well. So I'll go with Mourinho. You've just triggered me into there. So my five guests would be Muhammad Ali, Pete Sterling, James Maloney, Pep Guardiola, and Jose Mourinho.
Actually, I've got one final question for you. Catalans wins the premiership. They go treble. It's 1, 2, 3. Would you ever, because I've been hearing Eddie Jones wants to coach rugby league, would you ever consider coaching another sport?
Yes, and I have done as well. And back in, like I said, in 2013, we'd got beaten the World Cup semi-final.
Yeah.
And I was deciding which path and which way my career was going to go next. And Bath Rugby Union, it was actually, you know, Sam Baird just went to Bath the following year as well. But it was Bath Rugby Union. And I actually was close to accepting the deal to go there until Trent offered me the opportunity at the Roosters again. So, it's something. I think, you know, once you've, you know, I've been fortunate. I've coached in some great places. You know, look back recently, you know, living in the eastern suburbs, you know, in Clovelly, you know, what an opportunity, what a place to live in Auckland, in the south of France. They're all exciting projects. The jobs have been great jobs. And I think as a coach, you need that buzz, you need that challenge. And what is going to challenge you next? You know, and I often think a different sport would make you stop in your tracks. Yeah, you take your knowledge you've got from your game and the management experience, but how would you develop that and change that? And I think for all of us, that feeling of was it going to work? Is it not going to work? That actually keeps us alive at times as well. So, yes, I would consider that.
Definitely. Well, mate, thank you so much for your time today. It's been really insightful. And, mate, I'm looking forward to grabbing this beer with you, hopefully next year when I come over. Fingers crossed.
No, yeah, exactly. But, mate, you're more than welcome. Stay in touch.
Yeah, definitely. And all the best for the team, mate. Hope the boys get better soon. And I'm looking forward to seeing you guys in the grand final this year, mate. So all the best for it.
Yeah. Cheers, mate. Really appreciate it. Thanks a lot.